my yearbook for some reason, and she said, why does everyone look so old? And I'm like, I don't know. That was the style of the time. It's just what we looked like. And then, like, Orson Welles is 25 in this movie. And it's like, really? Like, think of every 25-year-old person you know now who's, like, just, like, some skinny hipster moron.
Welcome back to Box Office Bylines, a podcast about movies, about journalism, the headlines, the deadlines, the insiders, and the train wrecks. In Yellowknife, Northwest Territories, I am Jacob Boone, journalist, editor, newsletter guy, joined, as always, by...
In Halifax, Nova Scotia, home of Autumn, Tara Thorne.
I guess it would have been joined, as always, from, and that would have set up the place.
That would have been better, yeah.
Sorry.
That would have been correct. No, I did it wrong.
Yeah, Orson Welles, an old man in a, his whole life.
Truly.
Love that. As someone who started going gray in high school.
Yeah.
Nothing but respect.
They're so mean about it, though. Like, as you know, because of this film's stature, there's so much trivia. And so sure. much of it was like, well, he would have lived longer if he wasn't so fat. He was only 70 when he died. It was basically like the decline of Orson Welles. Like, he came out hot from this, and then that was it. It was just a pile of shit. Pile rolling downhill.
Not the worst way to go. Make what's regarded as the best movie of all time.
Yeah.
Wasn't at the time. But,
no,
you
wasn't.
Know, do some great stuff, and then have two steaks and pistachio ice cream and scotch every night for dinner until you
there
eat
you
yourself
go.
To death.
Here's my thing about this movie. I mean, I have lots
we
of
We should introduce it first.
Yeah, sure.
Because today we're talking about Citizen Kane, a name we all know across the land.
From Kang and Kodos.
From 1941. Directed, of course, by Orson Welles. Written by, contentiously, who knows?
Ooh, hashtag.
Mank himself, Herman J. Mankiewicz. Orson Welles and John Houseman. And starring O.W. plus Joseph Cotten, Dorothy Cumming.
O.W. as he was known at the time.
A whole bunch of other actors who hadn't really been in much before this. They,
no.
I think, tried to get new stars to the silver screen. And of course, for anyone who hasn't seen this widely known movie, but maybe not everyone's seen it.
I had not.
This is my second time. Mm-hmm. Following the death of publishing tycoon Charles Foster Kane, reporters scramble to uncover the meaning of his final utterance, Rosebud. Sorry. Now, what were you going to say about...
Well, okay, so my thing about... Okay, so Hamilton... Which I'm not comparing to Citizen Kane. I am just saying, what kind of fucking dork is like, I'm going to write a rap musical about American history? Mm-hmm. The answer being Lin-Manuel Miranda. What 25, allegedly, year old man is like, William Randolph Hearst, I must dig into this. I must make a feature film about it. That's my impression of how they talked. But it's like, I just don't, like, I guess he was doing theater and stuff. It makes me wonder if they were lying about how young he was, Spielberg style, because it makes no sense. I guess you're coming out of you're between wars, so things are very serious, but I'm just like, why is this interesting to you?
Well, it's 41, so it was in a war.
Yeah. Yeah, Hitler's in this movie briefly.
Maybe it was a few years, but I could see someone in their 20s being fascinated by...
Tycoonery?
How does, the most powerful... person in media or American politics and business make their empire, and how does that destroy them internally, and what weakness does it give? This is basically like a therapy session of Kane, though we never actually like, and one of the reasons I like it is we have a reporter, several reporters, but one main reporter investigating, trying to find out like the meaning of this man's life, so that they can have a fresh angle for their magazine report. And no one ever figures it out. Because, and it is just basically like his mom gave him away. And so he was sad and he wanted to be loved.
Yeah. And we can relate.
Well, sure. But I mean, Anyway, it's so. I mean, that's one of the reasons I like it. I think it's still shockingly relevant,
mm-hmm.
In terms of our gross billionaire overlords that rule our that own the Washington Post and travel to space, and maybe just need to spend some time on themselves.
Yeah, I thought, you know, it was hailed at the eventually. For being like a subversion of form. So it wasn't like a typical movie in the way that it was written, and it goes for a while. It like gives you it's like a big info dump off the top.
There's a 9-minute newsreel opening.
Yeah.
Summing up Kane's life because he had just died.
Yeah, which I feel like if you did that now, you'd be like, "Wow, cool storytelling prowess." Like, you have to give us all the information. But it kind of just, like, gives it to you. And then I kept being like, when's the movie going to start? Isn't Orson Welles in this? And then he shows up. You're like, oh, there he is. We're going back in time. I get it now.
The sheer amount of flashbacks,
mm-hmm.
which are, like, within flashbacks, it's like a Tarantino movie.
It's like Memento.
Yeah. You know, and that opening news 9-minute newsreel would have been much more familiar, I think, to moviegoers at the time, who were getting newsreels at the start of their pictures.
Definitely.
It is old timey in a lot of ways, and yet so much of it is very modern and fresh feeling when you watch it.
Mm-hmm.
The editing, the a lot of the stuff that it was doing, not inventing, but kind of putting together for the first time. In like a major Hollywood motion picture, because a lot of, you know, the deep focus and the theatrical lighting that goes back to like German Expressionism and all sorts
of shadows. Lots of shadows,
montages and cross cuttings and non-linear storytelling. Stuff that like college film students will do as a cliche today.
Yeah.
That were fresh and original in the early 90s maybe or 70s. And here, first time, 25 years old or so, putting it together in one movie, 1941.
And he had carte blanche from the studio, which never happened, and lied, like wouldn't let them in. Even when...
All right, so...
Yeah.
Let's talk about some of that. We could go back a little more to like the form of the movie, and there's some stuff to talk about, but one of the most contentious meta narratives about Citizen Kane is who is the author of this film.
Mm-hmm.
David Fincher has thoughts.
Very long black and white thoughts.
Pauline Kael has thoughts.
Oh, she did she ever.
Famously, the Citizen Kane essay, which was like 50,000 words or something, about Manx penning the screenplay and whether Orson Welles just like took sole credit. And there's also the cinematographer, whose name I have, but I forget. It's fine. Who, you know, implemented all this stuff. And Welles was, at the time... so magnanimous to say like no, this is his like they put his credit up on screen with Welles, and that was Orson Welles' choice, because like which wouldn't have been a thing that happened, because he felt like no, this movie is his as much as mine. And you know, we've talked about the auteur theory.
Ugh, it's
and
the worst.
Who makes movies. And I think this is an interesting case of, like, who is this movie? It's so tied up with Orson Welles and the myth of Orson Welles.
Yeah.
And yet, like, clearly there was someone else who was instrumental in putting together the bones of it. And you had a camera person and his team, let's be frank, who were doing and putting together and implementing all of the things it's really famous for.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. Can you say there's one, as someone who's made a film, can you say there's one author of a movie?
Oh, God, no. And I think, you know, Welles also tried to bribe Mank out of his credit. He tried to pay him. Because, like, if you're Orson Welles and you're like, I have directed and starred in multiple timelines, produced and wrote this thing, like, you want the whole package. You want to be like, I fucking did it all.
Yep.
And obviously, clearly, there was... I hesitate to use this word, especially with men, But there was a genius at work. Like, there was. Like, you don't... I'm sorry. Like, whatever... However he acted, you don't get handed all of these things at 25 because someone's, like, feeling like taking a risk today. Like, you have... Like, this was after War of the Worlds. Like, this is a great investment. But, you know, credit, in especially in old Hollywood with the blacklist and stuff, too, has always been sort of contentious. But yeah, as you talked about that, I was like, man, was Orson Welles the first, like, auteur theory guy? Like, probably not, because he was a big fan of John Ford.
Yeah. Yeah.
All directors of that time were considered auteurs.
So you, well, yeah, but the studios were so involved
You're right. They owned
the
them.
Production. Yeah. I was listening to a Matt Damon interview recently.
As one
and
does.
And he talked about...
Stillwater.
But he talked about John Ford, how, like, at the time, the directors would have to edit in their heads, which is where, like, Eastwood learned this and why he does so few takes, because the studios had final edit. So the director would just shoot and then hand everything off to the studio.
Wow.
So if you shoot exactly what you want so that someone can't edit it another way...
Yeah. That's
then
right.
You get to make the picture you want. And so, as you alluded to, one of the most controversial aspects at the time for this movie was the contract that Welles had with RKO. It was for two movies, actually, this one and I forget the other one he made under it. Anyways, but so long as the budget didn't exceed $500,000, all 153 RKO executives, who I'm sure would have all had notes, would not be allowed to see any footage unless Welles chose to show it to them, and no cuts could be made to the film without his approval. He was allowed to develop the story without interference, select his own cast and crew, and he had the right of final cut, which was utterly unprecedented at the time, and like deeply resented by other people in the film industry that he got this. And I mean, you know, the idea of like art versus the business and who should have control, I'm just recently Scarlett Johansson suing Disney for breaching her contract and people going to Disney's defense
very
comes to mind
fucked up
in terms
take.
Of like
yeah,
you know, how much the studio gets involved and how sometimes people just submit to like, yeah, that's the best way to do it rather than just cutting a check to some crazy weird artist and letting him make something. And
well,
there will be lots of interesting failures there, but you might also end up with something really great.
Yeah, totally. Like, I mean, and that's why A24 is like a celebrity distribution house, which is a fucked up thing to say. Like, who's in, like, they sell their own merch and people buy it. It's a movie company, you know, but they do that. They take risks on, you know, maybe people with less proven track records, or they're very good at finding audacious things that also capture the zeitgeist. And they do take the chance. They are artist driven. But if you're a giant movie studio, especially in the 30s, especially coming out of the Depression, you're like you're less likely to not bet on a sure thing. You do want full control, and I get that. You're putting up the money.
Yeah, sure.
Here in the country of Canada, the government is the studio, so it's a different thing.
There's probably some parallels with journalism too, in terms of like. Just providing the money to let a good up-and-coming reporter do their work without having several layers of editors and publishers get involved.
Weighing in. Yeah, yeah. So yeah, like, in terms of, like, who is the author? The director's the author because somebody has to be. Like, there has to be somebody at the top.
But it's the producer who gets the Oscar.
It
wins.
It is the producer that gets the Oscar. You're not wrong. And, you know, lots of people don't have great relationships with their producers after a movie. I do still.
Like, that's the thing about, like, the auteur theory that I think it was very useful in helping people understand that there is a creative vision at work behind this. And that can come maybe predominantly from one person. But now, because it's so accepted as fact that, you know, we just like, oh, Joss Whedon's doing the Avengers. Well, this is from the mind and heart of Joss Whedon. And it's like, no. Or any of these Marvel movies where it's like, no,
there's
all
a
of
giant
this is...
there's a giant pile somewhere, like, with the whole map of the whole thing, and then you pick them out. You're like, here's yours, do this. They're like, okay.
I think generally it still undervalues the creative collaboration that's involved from all departments and all people to make, and including the actors as well, to like just put something together and create a project that's very difficult to make, truthfully.
Totally. And people are really turning on auteur theory now because, first of all, we're like tired of the myth of the male genius. It's not like Nicole Holofcener, you know, auteur, even though she is just as much as fucking Scorsese is, but we don't think of her in the same way because she doesn't make quote unquote important movies. But also the way that people are being treated on film sets is different. So this idea of like there's a ladder and the PA's at the bottom and the director's at the top and everyone, you know, and yelling and being dickheads, like all that's going away. I mean, probably not in Hollywood for a long time, but it's starting to go away. So, there definitely are people that value the collaboration. Like, listen, I was the least knowledgeable person on my set. There is no reason on the earth I should have been directing that film. Like, for real. I don't know how it happened. I didn't know shit. I literally was like, what do I say? Honestly.
You wrote it.
I did write. No, I mean, like, what do I say, like, on set to people? Okay. Like, what do I say to make the camera go? Like, I walk in and the set just ran and I didn't have to worry about it. And I don't know how it happened, but it did. And that happened to Orson Welles, too. Except he probably made more money than me.
Maybe a little bit.
Maybe in 1930s money. It was probably the same. I mean, he came from the theater. He wasn't used to making money, to be fair.
Okay, so going back to some of the things technically that the movie did.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't invent, again, but brought together, used Greg Toland. That was the name of the cinematographer. Sorry. So most obvious one when you're watching this is Deep Focus, which I think there were some scenes that had a little bit of trick camera photography. There's some split diopters in a couple shots. Anyway, but they came up with more powerful lighting and they also muffled the cameras. To be able to, because they had to use lenses or get things closer. I don't know. Anyway. The opening title with no, like, opening credits was very rare at the time. First film score of Bernard Herrmann.
Imagine.
Right?
Yeah.
First coated lenses for shooting a picture. Don't really know what that means.
I don't either.
Okay. Flashbacks obviously weren't something, especially very immersive flashbacks, nonlinear storytelling, unreliable narrator in terms of like having the audience question what's being said and who's saying it. Which again, going back, and I loved learning this at the time, there were very strong debates in very, you know, angry European film critic circles, which I imagine had a lot of cigarette smoke. About whether a film should impose itself on an audience, whether that was unfair. There was a famously, it got, this film was slammed by Jean-Paul Sartre because it wasn't in the present tense, in his words. And a film shouldn't be anything but happening in the present tense. And of course, in Soviet Union, they're coming up with all sorts of weird things. But that was the environment this appeared in, that like anything other than a straightforward Hollywood picture was in some ways blasphemous. And again, we're watching the good ones that have made it through. We're not watching the 5,000 shitty films that were released that year that would be unbearable to get through, even if they were only like 70 minutes. Anyway, so all these techniques Welles learned from watching other movies. He got given a handmade film textbook by production advisor Miriam Geiger to reference all these studies. He matched the visual vocabulary of The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari from 1920, other films by Frank Capra, Fritz Lang, Jean Renoir, and as you said, John Ford's Stagecoach, which he said he watched almost 40 times during production.
He must have just watched it every day when he got home.
Yeah. And to your point, one of the things when he asked, like, where did he get the confidence as a first-time director to direct a film so radically different, he said it came from sheer ignorance, because it's only when you know something about a profession that you become timid or careful. So he didn't know what rules he was breaking, so he could just try stuff.
I mean, that's annoying for the people around you. I'm sure my people would attest to that, too. It's like, she doesn't know.
You know what? I think it was probably more annoying for the studio. I don't, in reading about it, it didn't seem like the production was itself any, in
troubled.
Any way like
troubled. Yeah.
It seemed like, I mean, they rehearsed it for weeks and weeks, like I think months before they shot anything.
Wow.
Which I'm sure for the actors was fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's, I don't know. It's a, I know it is maybe overblown a little bit. It's no Paddington 2. I haven't seen it that, but. There's so much to this movie that's worth hearing about and watching and thinking about.
There is.
And a lot of journalism, frankly, even though it doesn't really get included in, you know, the best journalism movies of all time. But
it's true. Yeah. And it's staged like a play. Like, it's not a ton of movement other than when he, like, trashes his room or whatever. But largely it's just like a static camera. And all of these, and it's like amazing to me that it is filmed like a play, but with a bunch of film techniques that hadn't really been used before. So he was like bringing the knowledge he did have, but also innovating the form, which I think is, again, goes to why people were obsessed with Boy Wonder.
That was also one thing he did. He really liked those low Dutch angles of looking up. So the camera's always like looking up at Kane to make him more imposing.
And down at the women.
Yeah, but you can't do that on a set that has no ceiling. So they built ceilings on everything and like hid lights within them, which, you know, there's a cost that probably the studio would have balked at, but lets you have some fun angles. Yeah, so this was your first time watching it. Did you enjoy it as it went along?
I did. I was like, why am I so captivated by this dorky thing? Like it's truly a dorky subject. And then I started reading up on William Randolph Hearst, who has also made an appearance in Newsies. And by all accounts was a big twat.
Yeah.
Just like a horrible person. And, you know, I love old Hollywood scandals. I really do. Like, they don't make them like that anymore. Everyone's, like, allowed to be gay now. It's not interesting. But, you know... It's like Hearst.
I'm just picturing the Cruella like Hearst movie where it's like, yeah, he's like bisexual and he's
everyone
like trying
knows.
To take down some villain that
so you know, it was, I always enjoy like kind of existing in that era of Hollywood that I know more of the background than I know the films. And I did sort of the same thing where I was like, who is the woman supposed to be? And it's like Marion Davies. But then it's like Marion Davies had an affair with Charlie Chaplin and they like someone got murdered and they covered it up. It was like a whole, I was like down a rabbit hole of old Hollywood. Like truly they don't do that shit anymore.
Murder people?
Yeah, I don't think they murder people as much anymore and cover it up. So, you know, I was sort of like, because of any old film, you kind of struggle a minute to get into the world of it because it looks so different. Everyone speaks so differently. They like physically look different from humans today. So it took me a second, especially when I was like, when's the movie starting? But then once we were in and like, and that's a real testament to the writing. So I could see why Wells would want to fight for his credit, whether he deserved to or not. It's like, you want to be credited with that writing.
It's also pretty funny. Those early, before his life goes terribly wrong and crumbles apart, and he becomes this like horrible, a hermit in his giant castle that he builds for himself because everyone's left him.
Xanadu.
When he's the swashbuckling newspaper magnate who, you know, buys out the entire newsroom of the competing paper and pledges to support the working man, and he's, you know, everyone loves him. It's fun until you realize, of course, that, like, yeah, that's all just vanity, that he doesn't actually care about any of those ideals.
Yeah.
There's a lot of, like, class play and politics in here, which is very astute. And, I mean, this is coming out of, it's set during the 20s. For the most part, it ends in the 40s, but like most of his life and career is like 20s into the 30s after the Depression. So it would have been, I'm sure, the Gilded Age was when? The teens? The idea of like someone, not just Hearst, because I mean, it is, Hearst is the main person there dramatizing in terms mm-hmm. of their life, but they're taking a lot of references from all over the place and mm-hmm. in terms of the general shape of an American millionaire's life, which was the original title, The American, I believe.
Well, speaking of all these things, Hearst publicly accusing Orson Welles of being a communist
yeah.
to try to get him blacklisted so to fuck up the movie. Like, what yeah. would be the equivalent of that today? If you, like, made a movie about Jeff Bezos, what could Bezos do?
He would find, like, tweets where you were in, like, blackface.
Yeah. Or
digitally alter them.
Accuse you of being a pedophile and, like, planting the evidence yeah. or something. Yeah.
Yeah, it wouldn't be hard.
Good to know.
Okay, yeah, as you said, there's tons and tons of trivia. Should we take a break?
I think so.
All right. Charles, I think I should remind you of a fact that you seem to have forgotten.
Yes,
that you are yourself one of the largest individual stockholders in the public transit company.
The trouble is you don't realize you're talking to two people. As Charles Foster Kane, who owns 82,364 shares of public transit preferred, you see, I do have a general idea of my holdings. I sympathize with you. Charles Foster Kane is a scoundrel. His paper should be run out of town. A committee should be formed to boycott him. You may, if you can form such a committee, put me down for a contribution of $1,000.
My time's
on the other hand, I am the publisher of The Enquirer. As such, it's my duty, and I'll let you in on a little secret. It's also my pleasure to see to it that decent, hardworking people in this community aren't robbed blind by a pack of money-mad pirates just because they haven't anybody to look after their interests. I'll let you in on another little secret, Mr. Thatcher. I think I'm the man to do it, you see. I have money and property. If I don't look after the interests of the underprivileged, maybe somebody else will.
And you're back with Box Office Bylines, where this week we're talking about an underdog of a film called Citizen Kane.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I did dig into the trivia a little bit because I wanted to confirm Orson Welles' age. Because I was like, am I wrong about this 25-year-old thing? I wasn't. I will say, old person makeup is one of my most hated Hollywood things. Mm-hmm. And it was not good. It's not good. It has not gotten better since this movie in 80,
well, that's the
90
thing.
Fucking
I'm
years.
More I'm more upset that it hasn't gotten better
yeah.
since the 1940s. Like, I'll give them a pass in 1940 to not get it right. And what I don't know if this is in my trivia, but as you mentioned, Welles is sort of an old-looking young man.
Mm-hmm.
So they had to, like, youngify him as well. Like, put the clips on the back of his neck or whatever to make his skin totter and things like that. And he actually said, like, that was better than he actually looked at that age. So I think that probably helped them in terms of him being able to play, you know, 25 to 45 without too much makeup or mm-hmm. 55. And then, yeah, really it's just that those last few scenes where he's the old cantankerous man. And he can't really move either in his, like, old man suit.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Before we get into trivia, something we didn't talk about is what did Rosebud mean? I remember talking about it in high school or something. And it's just like, it seems very obvious. I don't know how it was ever a debate.
Well, yeah, they show you at the end.
Yeah, right? Like, literally.
Yeah, the sled.
Yeah.
Why were they talking about this in high school?
Innocence of youth. I don't know.
Oh, like metaphorically, symbolically,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
What does it
yeah,
represent?
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Yeah, I think, you know, the unattainable,
yeah.
If you want to get, like, really deep with it. But I think more simply, it's like, you know, Kane wanted a happy child, or, like, he thinks back to when he was last happy before his mom sold him,
mm-hmm.
which it's implied, like, she doesn't really care for him all that much, and also that his dad's going to beat him.
Even
so
though his dad wanted to keep
she sells him.
Yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like a happy home to begin with.
It doesn't pitch women very well, this whole movie. We neglected to mention the slap, which was the style of the time.
So, yeah, it's him, I think, just remembering back to, like, a happy childhood, and that's what he wanted, versus being given, basically, the entire world.
Attaining everything.
And then trying to force that world to love him
mm-hmm.
the way he wanted, and that never worked out, and so you end up alone with an entire city of artifacts. That great last shot where everything's piled up like a skyline as it pans over it, and it turns out just the one thing he wanted was just, like, a happy childhood, And that's not what he got. And you can't ever get that, even if you do have your sled.
And it also helped me understand the Bobo episode of The Simpsons more. I didn't recognize the reference at the time.
Or the episode where Marge works at the power plant where they do the song and dance number from this at the retirement party.
Also, you know his name. Literally, yeah, his name is Burns, Monty Burns. Also, obviously, Citizen Kang, Sweat of the Good. Excellent.
It's been referenced in a few things over the years.
Yeah, a couple things.
Okay, so despite all the publicity, all the fame and acclaim that it's received since, the film was a box office flop and quickly consigned to the RKO vaults at 1941's Academy Awards, which I guess still earned 9 nominations, but every time it was announced, it was booed. Imagine if they did that these days. I would love that if films got booed for being shitty at the Oscars.
For real. And Hearst would have been such a powerful person, and he was so mad. It's like a New York Society kind of a thing, where I'm sure that he just had people against him.
So during filming, Wells received a warning that Hearst had arranged for a naked woman to jump into his arms when he entered his hotel room, and there was also a photographer in the room to take a picture that would be used to discredit him. Mm. So Wells spent the night elsewhere. It is unknown if the warning was true. Weirdly mirrors what gets Kane out of politics, because his opponent's going to expose him for having an affair unless he drops out. And Kane says, fuck it, I love her, and I'm still going to win. I got the people behind me, and then he loses.
He loses, and then
he has to try and save face by building an opera house for this young woman who doesn't really want to sing to begin with.
No,
but he thinks that'll bring them acclaim. Yeah. No. Yeah. Hearst was so angered by the film that he accused Wells of being a communist, as you said. What else? There was a whole bunch more about Hearst, but I guess I don't have any. So Wells later told filmmaker Peter Bogdanovich that he regretted how Marion Davies' reputation had suffered due to her popular misidentification with the character of Susan Alexander. Wells claimed the tycoon Harold Fowler McCormick's lavish promotion of the opera career of his second wife was the direct influence for the character. And I guess Wells and Marion Davies ended up becoming, if not friends, but acquaintances. He wrote the introduction to her autobiography.
Interesting.
Yeah. Because I don't think she never married Hearst.
No.
No. And just he probably died 50 years before she was 30 or whatever.
Yeah. Some of those open secret things like Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn.
What? I'm just hearing about this. Okay, what else? So because of the strange contract, Wells had a lot of problems with film executives not respecting the stipulation of non-interference, and spies would arrive on set to report what they saw to the executives. Sometimes the executives themselves would arrive unannounced, at which time the entire cast and crew would cease working and start playing softball until they left. He also claimed that the cast and crew were in rehearsal while they had actually begun shooting, so the studio still didn't think they were doing anything.
Oh, wow.
And then there's a story, I don't think I have it here, where the studio paid for some journalists to show up to report on the over budget, behind production Citizen Kane. And Kane found out about it, and so when they arrived, the cast and crew were mid party, no, we're done filming for the week. So you guys missed it. We're doing great, but do you want champagne? Do you want some?
Wow.
And of course the journalists were sure, and then they wrote all these stories about, oh, it seems to be going great. Everyone's happy. They drinks. This one's fun and relatable a bit to me. Wells was not in good shape at the beginning of production. He was suffering from the effects of caffeine poisoning as a result of consuming 30 to 40 cups of coffee a day.
How?
He then switched to tea, figuring that the hassle of having to brew the beverage would naturally limit his intake. But, unfortunately, he had someone on call to brew the tea for him. And so it wasn't that much of an effort. It was for that person, but not for him.
Also, black tea has a lot of caffeine. Herbal doesn't, obviously, but
yeah,
a lot of tea is highly caffeinated.
His skin became the color of tannic acid.
Gross.
He would also go for long periods without eating and then put away 2 or 3 large steaks in one sitting.
Sure. Keto.
So one subplot, you mentioned this earlier, but one subplot discarded from the final film concerned Susan Alexander Kane, the younger second wife, having an affair that Kane discovers, and that was said to be based on Davies' rumored affair with Charles Chaplin. Scenes were written, storyboards designed, and apparently Hearst found out about that and grew even more irate, and Wells ordered the sequence deleted from the script. He refused to discuss the real reasons for its removal in any public forum throughout his life, even long after Hearst's death, as he claimed the elements of the subplot were so scandalous they could cost him his life. But privately, he did tell Peter Bogdanovich, and Bogdanovich would, of course, go on. In 2001, he made The Cat's Meow, which is all about how Hearst learned of the affair on a trip on a yacht, and walked into a room and thought he saw Chaplin, shot a gun, and actually killed Thomas H. Ince, a producer-director who supposedly died of natural causes.
And then Luella Parsons, the gossip columnist, agreed to cover it up.
Yeah, and got like he got her a job for life.
Yeah, Hearst Papers. Like, I 100% believe that happened. And that wasn't the first guy William Hearst shot either, you know?
Probably not. Maybe the first one he regretted. First by accident.
That means Charlie Chaplin was like running away.
Yeah.
And he was like firing at him wildly on a boat. Anyway.
Very action-y. I would have loved to have seen that scene. I would have loved to see an action and gunplay in Citizen Kane. And how Wells would have directed that. In the scene where Kane and his entourage set off for the beach from Xanadu, large birds are seen flying across the background. In fact, that background was lifted from science fiction, a science fiction film to reduce costs, and the birds are in fact pterodactyls.
Also,
possibly
I was like,
it came from King Kong.
They're driving cars up that beach.
Yeah.
Just on
to the Everglades.
Yeah.
Hearst, of course, didn't like the film. The film was not reviewed in any Hearst newspaper until the mid-70s. When finally the Los Angeles Herald Examiner's Ray Lloyd reviewed it. There you go.
Wow.
As we mentioned, one of the original titles was the American RKO head George Schaefer suggested Citizen Kane. Wells also wanted to call the film John Q.
Which would go on to star Denzel Washington.
Yeah, it was remade as that film. Wells actually came to dislike the Rosebud twist, calling it Dollar Book Freud. Just fun. In the original script, Kane's son survives into adulthood and joins a radical group attempting to overthrow the government. 33 years after the film's release, Patricia Hearst, granddaughter of William Randolph Hearst, was kidnapped and brainwashed. I don't know if that's debatable. Into joining the Sibianese Liberation Army.
Patty Hearst, big star in John Waters films. She's usually popping up.
Yeah, would have been fun. His son does kind of just disappear.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess that's...
He dies at one point. Right?
No, he doesn't die.
I watched a lot of movies. Maybe I'm conflating some details. I thought there was a car accident and he died.
No, that was something else.
Okay.
No, because his wife divorces him and takes the son.
Okay.
But we're kind of given an impression Kane doesn't really like the son or doesn't know how to be around him.
Classic abandoned, yeah.
Abandoned people are.
Mm-hmm.
The favorite film of Peanuts cartoonist Charles M. Schulz. There you go. Also, one of Donald Trump's favorite films.
Are you kidding? As if Donald Trump understands this movie.
His biographer Tim O'Brien has said that Trump is fascinated by and identifies with Kane. No shit.
Yeah, the money part.
It was revealed in the book This is Orson Welles during an interview with Peter Bogdanovich and Orson Welles that one, if not the, Rosebud sled used in the movie was bought at auction by guess who?
Marion Davies.
Big director who's a film wank.
Oh, Tarantino.
No.
Big director who's a film wank. Scorsese. Woody Allen.
Go for the... This is
big
one more
director
you're missing.
Who's...
An obvious one. We've talked about him on this podcast.
Oh. Mr. Fincher.
Nope.
Spielberg.
There he is.
Okay.
And that confused Wells because Wells thought they had burned the sled on set. Right. I think there were a few, and I believe it came out that, like, another of the props had been, like, just given to, like, a crew member's son, and Spielberg paid, like, you know, $100 million, and then this other farmer in Arkansas was like, yeah, I got one in my shed.
Let me get the spiders off of it. Here you go.
Final note, the Russian newspaper Bednota, featured in the movie's opening newsreel, had, by 1931, been merged with Socialistchesko Zemledayel, which was long before Kane's death in 1941. I hope someone got fired for that.
Cancel Orson Welles.
That's all. I mean, yeah, there's, look, books, volumes of things written.
That's
about
all,
this.
Except there's a library dedicated to it somewhere. Yeah.
But worth watching. It's 2 hours, I think, dead on. It's on all your streaming platforms. It is not as difficult to sit through as so many movies of the time.
Mm-hmm. It could have been, other than the slap of the mistress, that's like really the only offensive thing. There's not even any offensive, language of the time, or, you know, hating on the Jewish for some reason. Yeah. You know, like, just none of that. None of it.
I will say I liked it a lot better the second time, too, just because I wasn't as confused a little bit about, like, well, wait, what's happening or where are we going? Mm-hmm. Like, when you know the structure, you can kind of focus more on the writing and some of the camera work and just really enjoy it. So, yeah, highly recommend Citizen Kane. 2 thumbs up.
Yeah, you've heard it here first and only here.
Box office bylines boldly comes out in favor of Citizen Kane as a good movie. Anyway, Tara, where can people find you?
You can find me at ThornyHFX on Twitter, and you can find you, Jacob, at RWJBoone.
They can find the show at Box Bylines. If you want to be on the show, like our recent guests, and talk about a movie, let us know. If
you're a journalist, just not just a random schmo.
Who's listening to the... Yeah.
Our friends.
If you want to sponsor us or buy us out, please get in touch.
Pay us in cheese. I'm fine with it.
And until next time, stay between the lines and keep shipping the news.
Bye.